Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Me Too Effect, What Happens When We Believe Women, by Lee Gilmore. Narrated by Lee Gilmore. For Beth Marshall. Preface. When President Biden nominated Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to the U.S. Supreme Court, fulfilling his campaign promise to appoint a black woman, it should have been cause for celebration. Instead, it devolved into a rerun of the mistreatment of Anita Hill, a black law professor, and Christine Blasey Ford, a white psychology professor, who had accused previous nominees of sexual misconduct. How does Me Too enable us to connect two witnesses who testified about sexual harassment, Hill, and assault, Blasey Ford, to a third, herself a nominee to the court, and the bizarre accusation that she harbored sympathy for child molesters? When Me Too transformed the iterative phenomenon of one wretched case after another into a demand for accountability, it exposed a pattern of how institutions use formal processes against those who report sexual harassment, draw on a supply of racist and sexist bias to slander them, and turn their allegations against them in lurid and parodic ways. Anita Hill, Christine Blasey Ford, and Ketanji Brown Jackson, although distant in time and circumstance from one another, were denigrated by gendered and racialized smear tactics honed over time. Although the individuals change, every week brings new examples that expose the prevalence of abuse and the inadequate response to systemic sexual violence. So many, in fact, that I stopped trying to include the latest outrage in this preface, and to focus instead on what enables its repetition. The pattern persists because the racist and sexist associations required to reproduce it are entangled in processes that are enshrined as positive and fair. For this reason, our first thoughts about justice and protection are often for abusers rather than survivors. Those who try to report sexual abuse are ensnared in Kafkaesque processes. They are often told that there are no procedures for their complaints, or their complaints are recorded only to be shelved. When they follow up, often years later, they are told that the statutes of limitations have expired. In contrast, abusers are often familiar to authorities, including police, religious leaders, and school administrators, and benefit from the appearance of a fair process that entails no accountability. These same formal processes allow men, especially white men, to defame women, especially women of color, as threatening to the rule of law, confused about sexual abuse, and undeserving of respect. While the similar mistreatment of Anita Hill and Christine Blasey Ford demonstrates that nothing changed between 1991 and 2017 to clarify how a charge of sexual abuse could be communicated, equally important is how Republican senators were able to transfer their attacks from these witnesses to a historic nominee in 2022 by acting as if she were on trial, sexually suspect and ultimately illegitimate. I begin with a recent Supreme Court nomination not because it uniquely captures the essence of Me Too, but because it is one among many examples whose appalling familiarity demonstrates why Me Too struck a global public as both necessary and long overdue when it appeared in October 2017. Me Too erupted on social media a few months after the publication of my book, Tainted Witness: Why We Doubt What Women Say About Their Lives. In it, I examine how cultural practices of judgment diminish women as knowers and persons worthy of justice. I theorized that women count less than men as truth-tellers because we are trained to believe men, to value their futures, and care about what might injure them in ways that simply do not apply to women. In addition to holding men in regard, we learn to doubt women. Doubting women is reaffirmed by the law and reproduced in workplaces, disciplinary processes, and everyday life. This doubt has the force of common sense. And it feels rational and ethical to direct it at women. Because doubt welds sexism to other forms of abuse and bias, like racism, homophobia, and transphobia, those who speak out are often discredited before any evidence is examined. Me Too raises a new proposition. What happens when we believe women? I use women here and throughout this book as a name people call themselves and also as a category of feminist analysis. Within feminist scholarship, women is not a neutral biological descriptor, but a concept that carries a range of legal, religious, political, and cultural meanings. It is inconceivable that we would minimize sexual violence as not that bad, a case of he said, she said, or an inevitable byproduct of women entering the workforce if we didn't already consider women to be worth less than men. There is no comparable dismissal of entire categories of harm without the related disparagement of the groups harmed. Racist, settler, and gendered regimes rationalize the violence they benefit from by defining its targets as essentially different and less than. For this reason, the use of women and men is not about nomenclature as much as who counts and who does the counting. Although Me Too has a global reach, some feel empowered by it while others feel excluded. For some of the same reasons, they feel included in or alienated from the category of women. At Judge Brown Jackson's nomination hearing, Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn, a Southern white woman, using a transphobic trope, challenged Brown Jackson to define what a woman is. Blackburn's demand was a potent reminder that words are charged with political meanings and histories of exclusion. Survivors who are young, trans, queer, poor, brown, black, or indigenous often find formal processes re-victimizing because they direct the powers of state, including carceral power, the power to imprison, at them. This is especially evident when they speak out about sexual violence. Me Too offers an alternative. As a response to hostile formal processes, Me Too uses the power of stories to raise the credibility of all survivors. Although Me Too is sometimes caricatured as a threat to due process or an example of carceral feminism most likely to harm people of color, the strategy of narrative activism is neither, at least not necessarily. While it seeks to hold abusers and their enablers accountable, and often does so by placing its faith in activism rather than courts, it typically builds a case through testimony, truth-telling, evidence-gathering, fact-checking, and public disclosure, when that testimony is blocked by the law. It relies on journalists to provide what police and courts often refuse survivors, uses labor actions to demand third-party investigations and other alternatives to forced mediation, and embraces the power of storytelling to create empathy and understanding in diverse audiences. I draw on the humanities, literary criticism, narrative theory, and feminist criticism specifically, to describe how survivors used narrative rather than strictly legal, administrative, or policy tools to revive a long-standing public conversation about sexual justice. This approach to Me Too exposes the asymmetry between two threats, one posed by sexual violence, which is decried by survivors and activists, and the other by truth-telling about it, which is characterized by its critics as dangerous and retributive. Me Too exposes this pattern of false equivalence and demands that we learn how to listen when survivors tell the truth. This book diagnoses why this is so difficult and how narrative activism makes it less so. It shifts the focus from demanding that survivors speak out to the features of narrative and reception that enable us to hear them. Introduction. The Me Too Effect. The best way to fight against misrepresentation is to represent oneself in radical numbers. Judith Butler, Gender Identity Memoir. We sound louder when we are heard together. We are louder. Sara Ahmed, Complaint. Much of the Me Too story is familiar. In October 2017, the hashtag blazed across social media when millions acknowledged personal experiences of sexual violence. Touched off by revelations of sexual abuse in Hollywood, Me Too blended celebrity scandal with grassroots feminist activism to ignite a conversation about accountability. The rush to cover that breaking story, however, was limited to recent events and overlooked the broader literary and cultural context necessary to make sense of its rapid adoption, as well as the backlash against it. As a result, Me Too was viewed variously as an extra-legal movement that threatened to substitute retribution for due process, an overreaction to the risks of sex that women once handled with silence, or an example of carceral feminism that would further fuel the criminal legal system's propensity to punish men of color. But women have been telling their stories for a long time, and none of those factors alone, not social media, celebrity, or even the sheer prevalence of sexual violence, explains why a global public heard them. By restoring Me Too to the broader context of life writing and survivor narratives, this book reframes the novelty of Me Too as a powerful episode of narrative activism within a long-standing, intersectional feminist lineage. When previously silenced survivors, including those who are non-white, non-binary, trans, young, or male, were heard as both me, singular and authoritative, and two, part of a testimonial collective of truth-tellers, disparate accounts fused into a shared story. This genre had a new name, Me Too, but its roots in intersectional feminism explain how far and fast it traveled, how it has been blocked, and how it might continue to provide survivors with collective credibility necessary to be heard at all. Me Too shifted the deeply ingrained response to women's accounts of sexual violence from doubting all of them to believing some of them. This rise in credibility upended the false equivalence between women's allegations of abuse, she said, and men's denials of it, he said. He said, she said, misrepresents a gendered hierarchy of credibility as a neutral binary. Through it, any individual woman's account is seen as less credible than every man's, which effectively suppresses knowledge about patterns of abuse. Yet where it once ended conversations about consent and harm, Me Too forced a new hearing. What changed? Although the downfall of Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein seemed to usher in a new era of accountability for powerful men overnight, the elements that converged to transform a handful of high-profile cases into a global demand for justice had been rising for a long time. Narrative activism, which I define as storytelling in the service of social change, propelled Me Too beyond courts and isolated cases into a global movement with survivors as authorities on sexual violence. James Phelan defines narrative as somebody telling somebody else on some occasion for some purpose that something happened. Precisely at a time when the cultural conversation about sexual justice was unhelpfully fixated on appeals to legal and bureaucratic systems, storytelling by survivors knit together concerns about consent and accountability into an existential demand for sexual justice and the right to be heard. Survivors told everybody that sexual violence happened in order to make it stop. This is not the first time stories of sexual violence have motivated audiences to take action. Me Too is part of an activist feminist lineage that uses autobiographical narrative to inform, move, and persuade diverse audiences about structural inequalities. Just as The Personal is Political summarized a key insight of feminism in the 1970s, Me Too referenced Black feminist activist Tarana Burke's recent work with survivors. Both phrases are shorthand for feminist praxis rooted in the creation of community. Both distill a shareable insight that translates the community-building side of activism for a broad audience. Sharing stories, whether through consciousness-raising groups, in print, in whisper networks, or online, is a core feminist practice that produces critical language about harm and justice. Where previous generations passed pamphlets, Me Too launched a global campaign on Twitter. Both used available technologies to speed testimonial accounts through well-traveled networks. Harriet Jacobs' Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, a slave narrative published in 1861, offers a provisional starting point for this tradition. Like Jacobs, Me Too founder Tarana Burke chose life writing, a genre that connects the personal and the political. Her memoir, Unbound, My Story of Liberation and the Birth of the Me Too Movement, locates the origin of the movement in an episode of thwarted storytelling with Heaven, a young girl whose story of sexual abuse Burke resisted hearing because she was me. Burke's focus on girlhood Heaven's and her own, recalls Jacob's attention to the disruption of her childhood by a slaveholder's sexual predations. To convince readers that she was degraded by the threat of rape, Jacobs persuades them to put themselves in her place and sympathize. She urges white women readers in particular toward a Me Too recognition of the harm white men do. Me Too, the words Burke realized would place survivors in a position of recognition and trust, came to her when she began to process her own sexual trauma. Her distillation of an intersectional feminist stance on survivor identification into a shareable two-word statement of empathy invited participation. Following the global sharing of Me Too on social media, personal stories like Heaven's and Burke's would soon pour out, prompting reinspection of patterns previously hidden or denied. Placing these accounts front and center enables a new perspective on how the credibility of survivors rose when women's vivid personal accounts were propelled into the court of public opinion, carrying a tradition of feminist activism with them. By clarifying the roots of Me Too, we can understand how survivors have used narrative to reframe themselves as authoritative and credible, to see abusers as accountable, and to identify sexual violence as an urgent problem requiring structural solutions. Me Too tapped into a lineage that links Jacobs to Burke to become another episode in the long-standing tradition of using personal narrative as a call to action. When social networks like Twitter enabled an outpouring of stories of sexual abuse, ignorance of this narrative tradition caused many to call Me Too unprecedented, highlighting the overnight change in accountability while omitting the feminist intellectual, aesthetic, and political context necessary for understanding three of its key features: why storytelling is the signature form of Me Too, how literature and life writing serve as a resource in the long struggle against sexual violence, and why narrative testimony rebalances the cultural conversation away from law, where survivors are structurally unequal to those who abuse them, and toward life writing, where they have greater flexibility in telling their stories and having them heard. As the group credibility of survivors rose, it created what I call the Me Too effect, the gelling of millions of diverse accounts into a collective voice that exposed systemic bias. Data on Twitter confirms that people posted Me Too after seeing six of their contacts do the same. They responded to what they saw with their own eyes, the voluntary assembly of a group to which they belonged. This collective assembly contextualized the October 2017 cases breaking on social media, with other examples of multiple accusers coming forward to condemn specific abusers. Allegations by actors Ashley Judd, Rose McGowan, and dozens more led to Weinstein's resignation, criminal trial, conviction, and 23-year sentence. Prior to that, the hashtag The Empty Chair referred to anonymous victims of comedian Bill Cosby, whom Andrea Constand and more than 35 other women accused of drugging and raping them. Although social media alone does not account for the global reach of Me Too, it is difficult to imagine it spread without Twitter's narrative power. Twitter embeds citation as a narrative device. Hashtags announce and remind users of a story, mark individual contributions as part of that story, and grow it through participation in a shared narrative. Like Me Too, Black Lives Matter broke on Twitter. Twitter was crucial to organizing actions in the Arab Spring, and the Occupy movement launched with the hashtag Occupy Wall Street. Twitter doesn't simply aggregate, it consolidates individual tweets into a shared narrative. When this happened with Me Too, a new narrator emerged, the credible witness, a collective identity for survivors wherever they were located. Feminist publics have previously emerged on Twitter around the issue of sexual violence, and Me Too tweets referenced that history through the citation of hashtags. Me Too connected cases outside social media to the history of protesting them online. Resonating within this frame were Brooke Neville's allegations of sexual harassment and rape against Matt Lauer, coupled with knowledge of his behavior by NBC staff and management who protected Weinstein. Rachel Denhollander's public allegations about sports doctor Larry Nassar led to over 160 women offering victim impact statements at his sentencing hearing, including some who had reported Nassar to police, to Michigan State Athletic Department staff, and to USA Gymnastics before their collective witness was allowed a place in court. As it became a frame of reference, Me Too offered an alternative jurisdiction for publicizing accounts previously smothered by indifferent or hostile authorities, including cases long silenced by statutes of limitations. This extrajudicial space nonetheless followed the rules of evidence and due process denied survivors by police and courts, with journalists taking on the ethical and legal responsibilities of evidence gathering, fact-finding, and fact-checking, and offering those named as abusers an opportunity to review and rebut their reporting. Signs of skepticism about Me Too were present almost immediately. Masha Gessen worried it would become a sex panic in the pages of The New Yorker on November 14, 2017, 1 month after the hashtag went viral. Through the end of the year and into the beginning of 2018, workplaces were conflated with dating culture in op-eds that presented objections to sexual harassment on the job as an overreaction to normal male dating behavior. A backlash took shape as writers like Katie Royfe and Daphne Merkin sought to shift the burden of accountability back onto women, mocking them for viewing sexual interactions as something that could be more egalitarian or even just less damaging, insisting that workplaces could not rein in men's behavior because boys will be boys everywhere. Iconic actress Catherine Deneuve and 99 prominent French women co-signed an op-ed affirming men's right to bother, endorsing a free pass for any and all sexual harassment. Because Me Too exposed decades of abuse within specific organizations, often by serial harassers, multiple survivors came forward to attest to patterns of abuse and retaliation. Abusers sought to describe these allegations as a witch hunt. They accused survivors of materializing from the shadows to terrorize innocent men with false accusations. The specter of the witch hunt seeks to scandalize the public with the fear of extrajudicial mob violence. It conflates survivors themselves with lawlessness and defends those accused of abuse by raising a seemingly reasonable concern for due process. This feature of the backlash united self-described feminists with anti-feminists. Some charged that even the moderate demand for a hearing represented a wild swing of the pendulum, dangerously overcorrecting the tendency toward doubt with a new requirement to believe all women. This caricature falsely presented survivors as demanding what justice can never offer, which is to be believed a priori. Me Too offered a different standard. A credible witness is one who can be believed, not one who must be believed. The backlash against Me Too as extrajudicial echoes the ways that formal procedures deny due process to victims. Held outside the law, but also blamed for not pressing a legal claim, due process represents a catch-22 for survivors. Jessica A. Clark argues in her article, The Rules of Me Too, that because traditional formal legal procedures fail to redress sexual harassment and assault, ad hoc processes have emerged to fill the gap. When victims seek redress through formal processes, they often discover they have two choices: either see the process through and be treated as the problem, or fall silent. Deborah Turkheimer observes that because formal mechanisms for reporting sexual harassment are so inadequate, women are forced into informal channels. In her recent book on the failures of the complaint process in higher education, Sara Ahmed observes that formal reporting exhausts, undermines, and typically defeats those compelled to use it. Disregard for survivors is built into the operations of the university. As Ahmed explains, we learn about institutions from the wear and tear of coming up against them, and we learn from the embodied nature of the work of complaint. We can be worn down as well as worn out by what we go through when we go through a complaints process. And yet, survivors go to great lengths to stay within formal processes, pursuing alternatives only after available processes prove more obstructive than responsive. Indeed, so-called informal procedures offer more rather than less due process, As Clark argues, rather than flouting due process values, Me Too's informal procedures have a number of advantages in addressing sexual misconduct while providing fair process when the accused person is a prominent figure. Survivors confront a criminal legal system that is hostile to their experience. Police, courts, and disciplinary processes in workplaces are non-responsive to sexual violence when they are not demonstrably hostile to survivors. This treatment explains why no survivor groups of which I am aware argue for extra policing or additional punishments. They demand instead fair and transparent processes for reporting, accountability within those processes for those who usually enjoy impunity, and independent investigations rather than forced mediation. Some also advocate for restorative justice, including programs for sex offenders within prisons, recommending reduced sentences for those who fulfill the requirements of these programs. They most frequently say they want to prevent further abuse. They often speak about wanting to spare their daughters and other girls what they have suffered. They seek to end the reproduction of violence and the processes that permit it. Finally, the assertion that extrajudiciality is itself the problem not only fails to address why the same survivors who are barred from legal redress by statutes of limitations might choose public personal testimony as a platform, it grants Me Too a force it does not possess. Unlike a change in law, the Me Too movement made no structural or institutional changes overnight. Me Too did not compel compliance across public and private institutions. Instead, it changed the public narrative. It shifted perspective and sympathies, introduced new voices and stories, and challenged dominant epistemologies about consent. Above all, it confronted a broad audience with a changed reality about the pervasiveness of sexual violence. When Me Too disrupted the routine minimization of sexual violence, it revealed two different ways to think about the chronic tolerance of a massive problem. The first is that because sexual violence is everywhere, it must be natural. Horrible, yes, but unremarkable. Although the right of men to engage in sexual violence per se is rarely asserted, a propensity for violence is frequently naturalized as an intrinsic aspect of masculinity. When men act in sexually abusive ways, their harm is often minimized as something intimate partners must tolerate because it cannot be changed. Yet every institution in which work, study, worship, and play take place is also a location of sexual abuse because the reproduction of power allows it. The ideology that the institution is good, the law is fair, and abuse results from the actions of a few bad actors has a common sense appeal. Common sense relies on the self-reinforcing logic that those in power stay in power for the good of the institution. Abusers retain positions of influence because they are often more aligned with institutional norms than are those who complain. Abuse is supported by processes that punish those who speak out, shield abusers from repercussions, and allow willing enablers and passive bystanders to thrive. Sexual abuse is adjudicated within structures that claim to be neutral regarding gender and race, but which embed this bias within their rules and norms. A very different way of thinking comes from survivors. Consent comes freighted with power imbalances, as a multitude of Me Too cases demonstrate. When there is a conflict over a claim of consent, power can be translated into credibility, enabling courts to favor men's claims of consent over women's claims of rape. Reading individual accounts of rape as examples of a collective problem, which is the core of Me Too, clarifies that women's diminished right to lodge credible complaints in processes that grant men impunity from those complaints is a structural problem. The minimization of sexual violence is no big deal, and rewriting of coercion as consent represents, he said, as a position of privilege. The privilege to name reality, backed up by the force of law. Survivor storytelling counters the normalization of sexual abuse and the myth that sexual violence is merely desire that gets out of hand. It reframes the consequences of excusing sexual violence to focus instead on the long-lasting negative effects on education, employment, and health that survivors experience. Framing Me Too as a threat to due process or a novelty rather than a resurgence of feminist activism.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?